Good morning, my friend. I hope you're doing well. I'm Dr. Lee Warren, and we are here for some self-brain surgery today. It's Theology Thursday, and on Theology Thursday, we usually try to tie some scriptural element, some spiritual element, some faith element to some specific science principle. And today's going to be a doozy, because today we're going to cover the ninth commandment of self-brain surgery. The ninth commandment of self-brain surgery is, I must believe that what I'm doing, I'm getting better at. We're doing a dedicated episode on each of the Ten Commandments as I write the definitive handbook of self-brain surgery. I'm going to give you tools to rewire your brain, reorder your mind, and radically transform your life. That book, be in prayer, please. It's in the hands of publishers now. We're working on pitching to publishers so we can decide who the perfect partner will be to bring you the handbook of self-brain surgery, hopefully sometime in 2025. And so as we get into this process of selling the manuscript, completing the manuscript, editing it, all that stuff, we'll be using the podcast to flesh out these ideas and bring you more deep dives into the content. But today we're going to talk about the ninth commandment. I must believe that what I'm doing, I'm getting better at. This is faith and neuroscience smashing together to teach you a principle of how your mind influences your brain and how your brain influences your body, how synapses and habits and circuits are made, and how you can make things better. Because I want you to get better at getting better starting today. We're going to get after that in just a minute. But before we do, I have a question for you.
Hey, are you ready to change your life? If the answer is yes, there's only one rule. You have to change your mind first. And my friend, there's a place where the neuroscience of how your mind works smashes together with faith and everything starts to make sense. Are you ready to change your life? Well, this is the place, Self-Brain Surgery School. I'm Dr. Lee Warren, and this is where we go deep into how we're wired, take control of our thinking, and find real hope. This is where we learn to become healthier, feel better, and be happier. This is where we leave the past behind and transform our minds. This is where we start today. Are you ready? This is your podcast. This is your place. This is your time, my friend. Let's get after it.
All right, you ready to get after it? Here we go. I love talking to and reading and learning from and spending time with smart people. That's one of the reasons I love Lisa so much. I was amazed at how beautiful she was when we first met. I was amazed at how well she sang. We met on the worship team at church. But mostly, I was amazed at her brilliant mind. I just love being around smart people. Well, recently, I discovered a very smart person who lived in the 19th century, died in the early 20th century. William James, a psychologist. William James, I first heard about him from Jeffrey Schwartz's book, The Mind and the Brain. Schwartz described a conversation that he had with quantum physicist Henry Stapp, who I'm also reading. Henry Stapp was the first guy to sort of figure out that you could direct the power of your mind, your mental force, as Schwartz calls it, and you could make structural changes in your brain, and that quantum physics is the mathematics behind how you can actually understand that that's a real thing. It's not just some self-help idea. It's not some mumbo jumbo. It's not some metaphysical magic. It's actually, there's a quantum physics mathematical explanation for how the things you think about can turn into real things in your brain. Well, way back in the 19th century, William James was writing about that. He was so smart. He observed human behavior and he recognized that habit has to have a physical basis. Now, let's just talk about that for a second. I'm going to read you some James. James says in his book, Psychology, the Briefer Course, on principles of the atomistic philosophy. Now, what does that mean? In the 19th century, the prevailing philosophy was that everything was made out of atoms, and these atoms were the smallest particles that there were, and they couldn't be changed. They were unchangeable, unmalleable physical structures that made up everything in the universe. Okay, that was the idea, going back to Newton, atomistic philosophy. So James is saying the principles of atomistic philosophy. On the principles of atomistic philosophy, the habits of an elementary particle, an atom, cannot change because the particle itself is an unchangeable thing. But those of a compound mass of matter can change because they are in the last instance due to the structure of the compound, and either outward forces or inward tensions can, from one hour to another, turn that structure into something different from what it was. That is, they can do so if the body is plastic enough to maintain its integrity and not be disrupted when the structure yields. What in the world are you talking about, Dr. Warren? So James was observing the universe. He observed, for example, that you could change the behavior of a bar of iron, that even though it was invisible and molecular, somehow the outward shape wasn't changing, but in a bar of iron could not be magnetic, and then something could happen and all of a sudden it was magnetic. Or you could take a rubber, and if you worked with it enough, you could make it malleable, and all of a sudden rubber could be used to shape and form and create other things, even though you haven't changed the appearance or the outward structure of the rubber. Something was happening to it that made it more friable, or plastic, as he called it. That word plastic doesn't mean what we think of it. You know, we think of a bottle of water that's made out of plastic. That's a plastic material. But the word plastic actually means something that's shapeable or malleable. And so he talked about plaster, how it sets and becomes hard. It changes its form because of its plasticity. So way back in the 19th century, William James is noticing that some things in the physical universe can change their shape, their behavior, their qualities, even though the molecular structure, he understood, atomistic philosophy, that means that the basic particles that make up those things can't change. So he was noticing that there was something up with the idea that atomistic philosophy might not be 100% accurate because things could actually change. But then he made the big switch. This is the brilliant switch that James made that, as far as I know, was one of the first people to ever talk about this sort of thing that we now routinely call neuroplasticity. He says this, plasticity then, in the wide sense of the word, means the possession of a structure weak enough to yield to an influence, but strong enough not to yield all at once. So if you try to bend the rubber and you do it, it's too stiff and you do it too aggressively, it might break, it might crack or fracture. But if the material is plastic enough, then it'll yield to that conforming influence slowly enough that it doesn't break, but it actually just changes. James goes on to say, organic matter, especially nervous tissue, he's talking about the brain now, seems to be endowed with a very extraordinary degree of plasticity of this sort, so that we may without hesitation lay down as our first proposition the following. The phenomena of habit in living beings are due to the plasticity of the organic material of which their bodies are comprised or composed. The philosophy of habit is thus, in the first instance, a chapter in physics rather than in physiology or psychology, that it is at bottom a physical principle, is admitted by all good recent writers on the subject. So James here in the late 1800s is saying, hey, when you change how you think, something structural must be changing in your brain because your brain starts to act differently. People can break habits, they can overcome addictions, they can learn new skills. He was noticing that the brain has some sort of plasticity to it. You can take a grown man who doesn't know how to write with his left hand, for example. You cut off his right arm, and he can learn how to write with his left hand. That means there has to be some structural changes happening in the brain. Well, guess what? Fast forward 100 years, now we have functional magnetic imaging scanners. Now we have advanced neuropathology techniques. Now we have electron microscopes and abilities to actually look at what's happening inside the brain. And guess what's been figured out? Your brain actually does make structural changes within minutes of you changing how you think or behave. And the underpinning mechanism of that is something called microtubules. We've done a couple of episodes of Microtubule Mondays, and microtubules are the sort of girder, the sort of internal structure that guides neurons as they're making synapses. And those things are created quickly and die quickly. And within minutes of you changing how you think, your brain starts to say, okay, this must be something we're supposed to automate. And your brain begins to automate synaptic structures to make that thought process easier. And if you persist in it for a while, you'll lay down the tracks of a new train of thought and it'll become automated and you won't have to think about it so much before all of a sudden you're in that same thought process, behavior, physiological reaction, whatever it is. And you know that's true already. The good example is you can learn how to use the keypad on your keyboard if you're punching in numbers. And at first you have to look at it. You have to make your hand type in 1, 2, 6, 8, 9, 4, 7. Right? But over time, you can do it in your sleep. You can drink a cup of coffee. You can be looking at something else, and you can be adding up all those numbers without even having to think about it, because your brain has learned how to operate that keypad. And that happened because microtubules laid down girdering and made structural changes to create synapses in your brain between your thoughts, your neural circuits, and the muscles in your hand. And that happened within minutes. Now, the bad news is those microtubular synaptic constructs that are made begin to be repurposed and degraded and removed if you don't do something new after you've learned it within about 3 weeks. So habits, systemic laying down of structural change in your brain can happen within minutes, but it'll go away within a few weeks if you don't continue to use those structures. Now, this obviously underneath it, how does the mechanism of all that work? Well, genes have to be switched on and off. That's epigenetic influence of your genetic structure when you decide to make new habits. And that happens within an hour that this structural stuff is happening. There's gene expression that occurs almost doubling within the first hour of new thinking around an idea. And those ideas, again, persist for up to 3 weeks without you doing anything else. Even if you just try something new for one day, there's some structural changes that happen in your brain and go away within about 3 weeks. So why am I telling you all this? I'm telling you this because the ninth commandment of self-brain surgery is that you must believe that what you're doing, you're getting better at. Why? Why is that so important? Because our world tries to convince us, your enemy, the society that you're in, your past history, your automatic thoughts, the feelings that you have that are wired in to make you feel like you're stuck, that all conspires to make you think that you, of all people, are the one person who is incapable of positive change. You're the one person who's really stuck. You're the one person who's always going to fail when you try something new. You're the one person who just can't get over this particular habit, just can't move forward after that one failure, just can't get over that one massive thing that happened to you. And I'm just here to tell you, friend, you're already made structural changes in your brain that you didn't even have at the start of this podcast, because what you're doing, you're getting better at. And so if you're listening to my voice and you're starting to hear yourself say, wait, maybe the physiology applies to me too. Maybe the way God made my mind will make my brain be able to change. Maybe I am capable of change. Guess what? You're already starting to lay down some positive structural change in your brain that can help you. You are not stuck, friend, because what you're doing, you're getting better at. Now, what's the flip side of that? If you spend your time rehearsing failure, ruminating on the past, thinking back on the thing that that person did that offended you and hurt you, guess what's going to happen? You're going to automate that thought. You're going to become better at being bitter instead of better at being better. If you're looking back in time, you're going to your therapist every week and drudging up everything that everybody's ever done to hurt you, and why you're so anxious all the time, and why you can't seem to get over what so-and-so did, and you need to figure out a way to blame your parents for all the things that are hurting you. Guess what you're doing? You're getting better at that. You're getting better at looking backwards instead of looking forward. And then you wonder why things aren't making progress, why you can't seem to break free. Well, it's because if you focus on something that's hurtful, you're going to get better at focusing on the thing that's hurtful. Let's go back to James, late 19th century. Just so in the nervous system, James says, the impressions of outer objects fashion for themselves more and more appropriate paths, that's synapses, he didn't have the word for it back then, and these vital phenomena recur under similar excitements from without, even when they have been interrupted for a certain time. What's James talking about? When you have something that triggers a synapse, a memory, a habit, a past failure, a rehearsed trauma, tragedy, or massive thing, whatever it is, if you have something that you've created a synapse around, you reach for a glass of wine when you get a certain text message, when you reach a certain time of day, you open up a bag of Cheetos because you've created that synaptic habit, because that's how you numb yourself so you don't have to think about the thing, and you're paying tomorrow taxes every day and you're not loving tomorrow more and all these other commandments that you're breaking. You do that because you've created a synaptic trail James calls it vital phenomena under similar excitement. So you have a similar stimulus, a time of day, a certain place, a certain trigger, a certain memory, a certain thing that you've trained your brain to fire at a certain time. And that's going to come back without you having to think about it. Why? Because what you've done, you've gotten better at, right? So the secret to overcoming it then is to direct yourself, direct your mind, to tell your brain to start making new pathways to replace those old ones. And within about 3 weeks, that's why everybody talks about 21 days of forming a habit, by the way. Within about 3 weeks, the microtubules are starting to break down and being repurposed and used for new synapses. So James calls this scar, this sort of synaptic scar that automatically fires. He calls it a locus minoris resistiente. This is such a brilliant connection that James made. LMR, locus minoris resistiente, is a term we use in medicine that refers to an injury or a pattern that shows up when something stimulates it. We see it in people with psoriasis, where the rash shows up in the same place over time because that area of skin has become conditioned to have that particular reaction when somebody's under stress, or a particular joint shows up with gout again over and over, even though the overall biochemical situation should be the same in every joint, but gout tends to show up. LMR, locus minoris resistiente. Here's what James said. In the nervous system, a scar anywhere or anywhere outside the nervous system as well, a scar is a locus minoris resistiente, more liable to be abraded, inflamed, to suffer pain and cold than are the neighboring parts. A sprained ankle, a dislocated arm are in danger of being sprained or dislocated again. Joints that have once been attacked by rheumatism or gout, mucous membranes that have been the seat of inflammation are with each fresh recurrence more prone to a relapse. This is why you bite your cheek in the same place. It gets a little swollen. It's a little bit easier for you to bite it again, and it just keeps happening over and over. James says, the more chronically morbid state substitutes itself for the sound one. And in the nervous system, it is well known how many so-called functional diseases seem to keep themselves going simply because they happen to have once begun, and how the forcible cutting short by medicine of a few attacks is often sufficient to enable the physiological forces to get possession of the battlefield again, and to bring the organs back to functions of health. Epilepsy, neuralgia, convulsive affections of various sorts, insomnia, are so many cases in point of these locus minoris resistiente, these LMRs, and you've got them too, friend. And to take what are more obviously habits, James says, the success with which a weaning treatment can often be applied to the victims of unhealthy indulgence of passion, of complaining, or of irascible dispositions shows us how much the morbid manifestations themselves were merely due to the inertia of the nervous system when once launched on a false career. I love the old language. What he's saying here, the false career. He's saying you can create habits and synapses in your brain because your brain is a plastic organ. And if you think about the wrong stuff, if you get in a bad mood, if you get routinely grumpy or easily offended, or you start rehearsing past traumas, or you start bringing up things that people haven't sufficiently thanked you for or apologized for or didn't give you enough credit for or didn't properly address you when you walked in the room, if you start rehearsing all that stuff, you're going to create an LMR, a locus minoris resistiente, that's more easily fired up the next time, even if it was a false start in the first place. Right? Because the truth is, people aren't out there spending their time figuring out how they can dishonor you or not live up to what you wanted them to be or not remind you of the way that they hurt you 10 years ago. Most people are just living their lives. They're not thinking about you at all. But you're spending your time rehearsing, replaying, rebuilding synapses. You're firing that habit again. You're opening that bottle of wine again. You're reaching for the cookie again because your uncle hurt you when you were 9, instead of finding a way to cut those synapses, repurpose them, and get better at getting better. Because the commandment is, what I'm doing, I'm getting better at. So William James, way back in the 19th century, saw this clearly. The brain has some ability to make new pathways, to break old ones and make new ones. And you've got to decide to break that inertia down that he calls the inertia of the nervous organs. You've got to decide that you want to make things better. Now let's bring it home for Theology Thursday, okay? Why does God care about your thinking? right? I mean, the whole society thinks that God's all about your behavior. He doesn't want you to have fun. He doesn't want you to have sex. He doesn't want you to drink alcohol. He doesn't want you to do this or do that. That's what the world thinks about God, right? The world thinks God's about rules and about stealing all your fun and about you not getting to do all the things that you think are going to make you happy. That's not what the Bible says. I love Tara Lee Cobble. Tara Lee Cobble said, read the Bible once and you might not like it very much, but read it again and say, I'm not looking this time for what I want out of it. I'm trying to find out who God is. You read the Bible from that point of view and you're going to see a God who cares about your quality of life, internal and external. And that's why Psalm 51:17 says that God doesn't want your bulls and goats and your blood sacrifices and all that. He says, my sacrifice, oh God, is a broken spirit and a contrite heart. That's what you won't despise. God wants your heart. Jesus said it. Don't talk to me about whether or not somebody's committed adultery or whether or not somebody's committed murder. Tell me what they think about. Because if you think about hurting somebody, you're just as guilty. If you think with lustful thoughts, you're just as guilty. I want your mind, Jesus says. That's why he said the greatest commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. Why does he use three different words here? Because back in those days, the people listening, they had different ideas. They thought mind and heart and gut and soul were all different things. Now we know they probably all are really different aspects of mental force that your brain exerts on, that your mind exerts on your brain. But in those days, when they said heart, they thought about your feelings. And when they said mind, they thought about your thoughts. When they thought about soul, they thought about your devotion to God and all those sorts of things. And then your body was the things that you actually did, and they were separate. Jesus is saying, I want all of it. I want all of your thoughts. And that's why the psalmist in Psalm 19:14, the man after God's own heart, said, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my God, my rock, and my redeemer. Why? Because your thinking is part of what you're getting better at or getting worse at. And when you think better thoughts, your brain creates better synapses. Your heart beats in a healthier way. Your body gets stronger. Your relationships get stronger. You improve your electromagnetic field. When you think better thoughts, you create better synapses and you make a better brain and a better body and a better life. That's why you can't change your life until you change your mind and what you're doing, you're getting better at. That's why it's the ninth commandment, because you deciding that you're going to follow the advice of 2 Corinthians 10:5 seriously and say, I am going to get my thoughts under control. I'm going to take my thoughts captive. If you take it seriously and you do that, guess what's going to happen? All these inertia of habit and thought that James was referring to turn into better ones, because your microtubules start breaking down old synapses within minutes of you deciding to think differently. God's payoff here is quick. He says, if you start thinking better thoughts, you're going to start feeling better feelings. You're going to start making better neurotransmitters. You're going to start making a better hormonal environment for the organs in your body. You're going to start feeling better and being happier and becoming healthier, because you're changing the way you think, and what you're doing, you're getting better at. And those locus minoris resistentes, those LMRs, are going to stop being so irascible, stop being so easily irritated. Your ankle's not going to turn quite as easily, the mental one that we're talking about here. Jesus wants your heart. And he wants your heart not because he's trying to be a big fuddy-duddy and control every aspect of your life, but because he knows that thoughts become things. We're going to talk about that tomorrow on Frontal Lobe Friday. He knows that what you think about, it turns into how you live. He knows that what you think about turns into how your brain functions and how your body functions and how overall happy and healthy you are. Because you can do all the hand stuff right. You can do all the sacrifices. You can do all the deeds correctly. And you can still be a miserable, lost, hopeless, desperate person in between your ears. And God says, I didn't come here so that your life could be stolen and killed and destroyed. I came here that you might have life and have it abundantly. And I'm just telling you, friend, if your thought life isn't abundant, nothing else in your life will be either. You can have all the money in the world. You can have the big house. You can have the fame. You can be the super movie star. And you've seen it before. Those people frequently are the most miserable, unhappy people. They drink too much. They have They have high divorce rates. They sometimes commit suicide because they're not happy in their heart, because they're not happy in between their ears, because they didn't know that what they're doing, they're getting better at, and what they're getting better at is becoming more miserable if they're placing their hopes and they're placing their thoughts and they're placing their mind on the wrong stuff. You can change that, friend. Your microtubules will respond to you directing them to break those inertias and break down those old LMRs and find some new ways to get your mind right. Because thoughts become things, and what you're doing, you're getting better at. We're going to dive more deeply into the 10th commandment tomorrow, remembering that thoughts become things. But today I want you to know that what you're doing, you're getting better at. So do you want to get better at getting better? Or do you want to get better at getting bitter? Do you want to get better at blaming? Do you want to get better at worrying? Do you want to get better at drinking? Do you want to get better at not getting healthier? Because what you're doing, you're getting better at. So if you want to actively practice the practice of getting better, it's going to be started by you thinking different thoughts. So take a moment today, just a second, when you find yourself going, gosh, I wonder why she didn't write me back, or I don't like the tone of that text message that I got, or gosh, I just spent 2 hours thinking about the last time I went to this event with my family that I have to go to next weekend, and the last time somebody said the wrong thing to me, or didn't compliment me on my dress, or didn't do this, or didn't do that, or didn't ask me to sit with them, and I'm rehearsing those traumas, and what I'm doing then is I'm building synapses to make it easier for me to rehearse those traumas again. And God says, time out. Think for a second about the fact that you've done things that I needed to forgive you for. You've let me down before. You've overlooked me before. You've not done the thing that I would like for you to have done in the right way before. And yet, I'm here offering you a whole new set of microtubules and synapses that you can have if you'll just change your mind. Just look forward instead of back. Just think different thoughts and you'll become less anxious. Just change your mind so you can change your life. Because my friend, what you're doing, you're getting better at. And the very good news here on Theology Thursday is that you can start today.
Hey, thanks for listening. The Dr. Lee Warren Podcast is brought to you by my brand new book, Hope is the First Dose. It's a treatment plan for recovering from trauma, tragedy, and other massive things. It's available everywhere books are sold, and I narrated the audiobooks. Hey, the theme music for the show is Get Up by my friend Tommy Walker, available for free at TommyWalkerMinistries.org. They are supplying worship resources for worshipers all over the world to worship the Most High God. And if you're interested in learning more, check out TommyWalkerMinistries.org. If you need prayer, go to the prayer wall at WLeeWarrenMD.com/prayer, WLeeWarrenMD.com/prayer, and go to my website and sign up for the newsletter, Self Brain Surgery, every Sunday since 2014, helping people in all 50 states and 60 plus countries around the world. I'm Dr. Lee Warren, and I'll talk to you soon. Remember, friend, you can't change your life until you change your mind. And the good news is you can start today.